Well, when you look up the word mockery in the dictionary, you find definitions that are similar to this one. Something like to make fun of someone by pretending that he is not what he is, by imitating someone in a distorted manner or fashion. It speaks of ridiculing a person. It speaks of cruelty. And the question that comes to my mind is, why do people do such things? Why do we ridicule? Why do we mock? Why do people resort to such behavior? Why would it ever seem like a good idea? Why do people get such pleasure from doing things like this? I think it really gets back to, it really, if you boil it down, it goes down to, gets down to evil. It's evil. Evil is a real thing. Whether or not people want to admit it, there are many people that don't want to admit that evil is a real thing, but we really do. We all have a sense of evil. We all have a sense that there is such a thing as evil, whether we want to admit it or not. Whether we want to operate in those categories or not, we believe that evil is real on some level. All of us do. And as Christians, we believe the Scriptures teach that evil is real. The Scriptures teach, Mark himself taught us in chapter 7, verse 23, that evil proceeds from the heart of man. Evil is active in the world because evil flows out of our hearts like water out of a fountain. And it doesn't just affect our thoughts, it affects the things we say as well as the things that we do. And so I want us to think about evil this morning. In light of the verses that we see here, I want us to think about evil, just the idea of evil in the world, in man, and in this passage. And I want to think about, secondly, does God deal with evil? And if so, how does he deal with evil? And then third and finally, how are we as Christians, as the followers of Christ, to think about evil and to act in light of the evil that we see both within us but are also around us? And so evil in the world, in man, in the passage before us, in the world, when we think about the idea of evil, thinking about good and evil, right? These categories seem natural to us as human beings, as I said at the outset. They seem natural to us. We all have a sense of right and wrong. We all have a sense of there are certain things that should be done, and there are certain things that shouldn't be done. I think of C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity. He talks about, you know, a child saying to another child, you know, give me a bit of your orange. You know, he's British, so he says things like, give me a bit of your orange. I gave you a bit of mine. And there's this appeal to what Lewis says is shared in common. This idea that you understand what I'm getting at. You understand the principle of doing what is right, doing what is just, because it's innate. It's not that somebody has to teach you that. It's innate within us. And there are certain things, right, that we are all appalled by, that we find to be morally reprehensible. I mean, like, you know, pretty much everybody feels this way about certain things. And there are other things that we feel like this is right and this is proper. And sometimes they're the same and sometimes they're different. And I think a lot of it has to do with where we're brought up culturally. Whether we're raised in a religion or not, whether we're raised in biblical religion or not, what denomination, what form of biblical religion, you know, different things. But it's informed, it's shaped and molded. But what I'm saying is, foundationally, we all have this sense of right and wrong. Everybody does. Everybody does. And you have to think, like, how do we deal with this? What makes the best sense of this sense of right and wrong that all people have and define differently, but this sense that they have? And we say, don't we, that Christianity makes the best sense of this. Christianity makes the best sense of it. That God created man upright. That God created man morally upright, in his image, in his likeness, in the beginning, and knew. God spoke and said, these are the things that you do and don't do. And I am of the firm persuasion that God gave to them the moral law in the garden. Not just a tree, but there was more to it than that. We don't have everything that was said. But God gave and said, this is right and this is wrong. And Adam and Eve were created upright. And then they sinned and plunged the world into a state of sin and misery. And the image of God is still there, but it's greatly marred. I mean, to me, that makes the best sense of what we see. We all have a moral grounding. We all have a sense of right and wrong, but it's different for each of us. It's different for all of us because of where we're brought up, because of what we're taught, etc. And it seems that this seems to make sense of what we see in the world. Why things are the way that they are. It makes the best sense. Sin in the world, we all understand it. Sin in man, because man sinned and rebelled and plunged the world and mankind into a state of sin and misery. And what that means is that man runs from God. You know the story in Genesis when Adam and Eve partook of the fruit and they rebelled against God. God comes to them, and what do? They run and they hide. They no longer want to have fellowship with God. They no longer want to spend time with God. They run and they hide. And God calls for them. God knows where they are. He's not having a problem with geography. He knows where they are. But he's doing it for them. Where are you? What have you done? And it's an opportunity for them to confess their sin. It's an opportunity for them to get right with God. To tell them what they've done wrong. And what do? They blame it on the others, right? What does Adam do? Adam says, it's the woman's fault. And ultimately, God, it's your fault. That's what sinners do. Blame others, blame God. It's the woman that you gave me. You see? God questions Eve. Eve, what did you do? Well, I don't know. Some of you know Flip Wilson. The devil made me do it. Right? The devil made me do it. Passing the buck, right? That's what sin does. Sin makes us hide from God. Sin makes us lie to God. Sin makes us blame others. But sometimes, given the opportunity, sin makes us get violent with God. Given the opportunity, violence ensues. And that's what we see in the passage before us this morning. There's an old Yiddish proverb that says, if God lived on earth, people would break his windows. If God lived on earth, people would break his windows. But here we see in the passage before us this morning, in the passage we looked at the last couple of weeks, and the passage that we'll continue to look at in the upcoming weeks, that with Jesus, even though he didn't own a home of his own, foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Even though he doesn't have a home, man does his very best, not just to break his windows, but to burn the whole house down. What would man do if they were given the opportunity to touch God? What would man do given the opportunity to get their hands on God. And what we see here is the answer to that question and those questions. This is what natural man wants to do to God. This. And so we read this passage, we read these words after the Israelites have reacted by arresting him and putting him through all manner of false trials and false situations and bringing false accusations and bringing a false charge and then beating him to a pulp and mocking him and saying, "Prophesy, who hit you?" They come up with another charge to bring before the Romans, the political leaders, because they've lost their own power and authority to put someone to death. They think he's deserving of death. He's a blasphemer, they say, even though he's not. Even though the high priest is the blasphemer, even though the high priest is the one speaking against God and his ways, because Jesus is the Savior. Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the one who said, I'm the Son of Man that's going to come in the clouds and be the ultimate judge. But they still bring charges and they beat him up and they mock him. And they bring a charge before the political leaders. He says he's the king of the Jews. Because again, as we said before, Rome doesn't care if you say you're the Son of Man. They don't care if you say that you're the Messiah of this little conquered people. But if you say king of the Jews, then that means you're contradicting Caesar being king, Caesar being Lord. And so now the Romans have a go at him, right? And they try to release him, as we looked at last time. And Barabbas, an insurrectionist and a murderer, is brought before the people. And the people, the crowd, the Jewish crowd, stirred up by the Jewish leaders, say, "Crucify Jesus." And I love the words. Pilate says, "Why? What evil has he done?" And what's their response? "Crucify him." We don't have an answer. Don't confuse us with the truth. We don't need an answer for that. Just, he hasn't done evil, but kill him anyway. And so you see evil men, religious, political, and otherwise, doing the wrong thing before a sinless man, a righteous man. And he's moving through the process, isn't he? Holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, like us in all points as we are, yet without sin. And here he is, moving through the process. Moving through the process. And so it says there, you know, the soldiers lead him away, but just before this, in verse 15, they're beating him. And, you know, it's this cruel and merciless preparation, this scourging in verse 15. Jesus is stripped down and his hands are tied to a post and his knees are on the ground and his back is taut like this, and they just start beating him, whipping him with this whip that has glass and bones and metal shards and pieces, and they're just whipping him. And then they, once it gets into his skin, then they yank it out and they pull big chunks of flesh out. And so his back just would look like just big pieces of raw meat. And the muscles, can you imagine what the muscles would be doing? Just spasming. You know, I put a shirt on that's a little too tight, my collar, and it kind of causes a little muscle spasm in my neck. Actually, this morning it happened. Poor me. In fact, from these scourgings, many people would actually die before they even got to the cross. But it's interesting that Mark doesn't really focus on the physical aspect, does he? He just kind of lays it out there. What's more interesting to Mark, and really all the gospel writers, is the shame and the mocking and the ridicule that comes his way. There's not really a focus on the beatings, not really a focus on the physicality. Maybe you've heard sermons and doctors have got up and talked about all the physical aspects of the cross and the suffering, and those are all interesting to know, but it's really not the emphasis of the gospel writers. What's being emphasized is the shame and the scorn and the mocking. That's more important to the gospel writers. That's more important to what these, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, are writing down. And it really does speak to the sinfulness of man and the evil that has touched men and affected men. Every one of them. And the question is often raised, maybe you've heard this before, whose fault is it that Jesus died? You know, is it the Jews? Is it the Gentiles, the Romans? Whose fault is it? Blood has been shed. Violence has been carried out because of such a question. You know the answer? Yeah. It's not an either or, it's a both and. It's both of their faults. To put it another way, it's all of our fault. It's our fault. Listen, it's your fault as much as anybody. Another thing that sin does, and I see this in my life on a regular basis, and it's greatly concerning to me, sin loves to magnify the sin of others and justify the sin of self. Man, I can sure see your sin. And there's times in which that's a good thing, right? Because none of us see ourselves as well as we think we do. And so it's a good thing for others to be able to speak into our lives and help us with the sin. Help us, I said. Did you hear me say that? Help us with the sin that's in our lives. Because we cannot say, nobody knows the sin, and nobody knows me like I know myself. Oh, lots of people know you like you know yourself, but they probably know you better because they see your sin more clearly. But I have this tendency to see my own sin in this really lessened way. It's not really that big of a deal. And I've got this big old magnifying glass as I look at the sins of others. We don't want to do that. We don't want to be like that. What's the problem with the world? It's me. And I hope every one of you can say that. What's the problem with the world? What was it, Chesterton? I don't know if that's true or not. By the way, there's a story that says G.K. Chesterton read an article in a paper one day, and somebody said, "What's the problem with the world?" And Chesterton wrote in and said, "Dear sir, the answer is I am." You know, and that was all he wrote. I don't know, that's kind of, maybe he said that, maybe he didn't, but it's true. Listen, the problem with the world is not those people over there, or those people over there, or that group over there. You know, in the words of a pop star gone bad years ago, I'm starting with the man in the mirror, you know. We got to start with us. It always starts with me. You have to say, it always starts with me. Paul would say of himself, "I'm the chief of sinners." He didn't say, "I was the chief of sinners because I used to persecute the church." He says, "I am right now the chief of sinners. As a man who walked with the Lord for many years and did amazing things and bore great fruit," he said, "I am the chief of sinners," because he saw himself. And the Lord opened his eyes to his own sin. And if we walk around saying, like Isaiah in the early chapters of Isaiah, "Woe is you," and "Woe is you," and "Woe is you," we don't get it. The Lord's got to apply the coal to our lips. So we say, "Woe is me," as he says in Isaiah chapter 6. And so the problem with the world is me. Hope you can say that too about yourself. That's the biggest problem. The problem of evil is the problem that's in my heart, that proceeds from my own heart. Even, by the way, as a sinner that's been redeemed by the blood of Christ, I'm still a sinner. Luther would say, I'm at the same time just and sinful. I'm a justified sinner. So before God, I'm righteous as far as my standing is concerned. But practically speaking, I still sin all the time. I don't justify that, but I speak the truth about that. I say what's true about myself. And I look at the beam in my own eye before I seek to deal with the speck in my brother's eye, in my sister's eye. I can imagine that as Jesus walked around on this planet and he saw his disciples getting after one another all the time, about, you know, you did this and that's mine and stuff like that, he probably was so, in a sanctified way, of course, frustrated. And I'm sure he was constantly saying things like he says, deal with the beam in your own eye before you seek to deal with the speck in your brother's eye. Come on, man. Get the focus where it should be. Start with you. Start with yourself. And so these people are sinful and wretched. But I hope you understand as you read through these passages and you look at the events that you see yourself in all of the characters that are opposed to and mistreating Jesus. See your own compromise in these various things. But the soldiers lead Jesus away inside the palace, the governor's headquarters there in verse 16, and they call together the whole battalion. And that would be 600 soldiers. And they call everybody together because, hey, we got this guy who thinks he's the king of the Jews, and it's just another failed revolutionary, and we're going to have some fun with him, you know. We're going to have a real good time. And so why do all 600 of these guys gather together and treat Jesus in this way? Because savagery begets savagery. It's like blood is in the water and sharks have gone into a feeding frenzy. And so you can kind of just imagine in this courtyard, all of these soldiers are gathered around and they're mocking and they're jeering and they're scoffing. And here in the middle is Jesus, who's just been beaten to a bloody pulp, beaten all over his face. His beard is ripped apart. His face is swollen. You can't even know what he looks like, according to Isaiah. And now all these guys are gathered around to watch an innocent man suffer still more. I mean, you can imagine how loud it would have been. And they take all his clothes off. He's undressed there. They put on probably a soldier's garment, as you look at the language here. And it would have only covered the upper part of his body. And so he's naked, and it's a shameful thing that they're doing to him. They're mocking him and making fun of him. They're degrading him. A purple cloak, you know, it speaks of royalty, but they're laughing. They're twisting together a crown, a gold crown like Caesar would wear, but this one is a crown of thorns, and it's digging into his head, and they're saluting him, you know, in this mocking tone, verse 18, "Hail, King of the Jews," like they would rightly hail, at least as they would see things, Caesar. "Hail Caesar!" But now in a mocking tone, in a mocking voice, "Hail King of the Jews." Striking him with a reed, verse 19, probably like a bamboo sheet, one of those long like pole type things. That would have been like a scepter, you know, but they're striking him with it. Kneeling down, verse 19 goes on to say, in false homage, mocking, verse 20. Before leading him out to crucify him. Maybe some of you have heard of Bart Ehrman. He was a Christian, grew up in a Christian home, and then began to write books against the Christian faith, trying to refute the Christian faith. And he became an unbeliever because he saw evil in the world. He looked around at the world and he saw sin. And he said, if there was a God, then there wouldn't be sin. There wouldn't be evil. There wouldn't be what we see in the world. God hasn't done anything, therefore there must not be a God. But the question as we transition, and these are quicker points, but to the second point, has God done something about this? Does God do something about what Ehrman knows, senses, is wrong with the world? But senses that God should and if he did exist, would do something about it. Has God, does God do anything about this? And I would suggest that he does. I would suggest that God does deal with evil by coming into the world and facing it head on in the person of his son. Scripture teaches that God personally addresses evil and the problem of evil by personally coming into the world in the person of his son, the Lord Jesus Christ. He doesn't deal with sin and evil from a distance. He gets personally involved by taking on humanity. You could say that God has invested not just for a short time, but permanently in overcoming the problems and plight of the world. I mean, you need to understand that Jesus takes on humanity. He takes a body to himself, not just for those 33 years. I think it's easy for us to forget. But forever. Does God deal with evil? Yes, by coming into the world. Does God deal with evil? Yes, by taking on flesh. Through the enfleshment, through the incarnation, he deals with evil. And in this passage before us, he takes the wrath and the, yes, the shame and the humiliation that is poured out upon him, and he does it for us. As you think about what we're reading here this morning, as we think about what Jesus has endured so far, we haven't even made it to the Calvary Road, the Via Dolorosa. We haven't even made it there yet. We haven't made it to Calvary yet, and he's already going through these sorts of things. And all of these things he's going through are for you and for me. Suffering immensely, taking the brunt of evil upon himself. See, no one can ever say, should ever say, God doesn't know what it's like. God doesn't know what it's like to face evil. God doesn't know what it's like to have people sin against him. He knows exactly what it's like. And by the way, I would... I think there are situations, I think there are times in life where we can just kind of get a sense of like, this is a heavy moment, because I feel like evil is really strongly opposed to me. The evil one and his minions are around, right? Like this is an oppressive type moment. This is a big deal, but it's nothing like this moment for Jesus. You think 600 soldiers is a lot? The devil and his minions are present. The satanic forces are present in full force, working through these folks. Jesus knows it. Jesus feels it. Jesus senses it. We could speak of all sorts of unspeakable acts that go on in the world, but Jesus knows what all of them are like, because of what he went through in his 33 years. Does God deal with evil in the world? He sure does. But the problem that many have is that he doesn't deal with it the way that they want him to. He doesn't deal with it in the way that they think he should. And can you imagine the arrogance there? Of a finite, though they wouldn't probably admit it, they would say they're imperfect, but sinful, finite person who would basically say, I know all there is to know, I know enough to be able to make a decision on if there is or not a God based on how I perceive things and how they should be fixed, carried out, etc. Might I even suggest to you this morning this, that the problem of evil isn't so much a problem for the believer, it's actually an evidence for God. It's not so much a problem for the believer, but it's an evidence for God. Why? Because if there is no God, there really needs to be no category of evil. Where does such an assumption come from? If there is no God, listen, then everything and anything goes. But why do the atheists that write these books, right? Why do they want to insist that you can be good without God? Why do they want to insist that you can be moral without God? Listen, why do you need to be good? Why do we need to be moral? If there is no God, Paul says, party and do whatever you want to do. If there is no God, there's no reason to be good. There's no reason to be considerate about and toward anybody else. Go do whatever you want. And if you need to use and abuse and offend other people, then do it. So the sense that there's a moral outrage really does speak to the fact that there is a God. And passages like this show us that God comes and does something about it in the person of his Son. And I wanted to stop and think about this, because three times Jesus is mocked. Three times people scoff at him in these ways. The Jewish folks after their trial. These folks, the Roman soldiers after their trial. And a third time as he hangs on the cross between heaven and earth. This is sin. This is evil. And again, the Bible makes the best case for what's happened, where it came from, and yes, that God deals with it. And deal with it perfectly and fully and finally in his way and his time for his glory and for the good of his people. And I think it's interesting also, as you look at this, that Jesus is passive here. As the one who goes about doing good, his whole life and ministry, healing and raising and bringing back together, now he just allows evil to be poured out upon him. He lets the evil actors act upon him. And still, through his passivity, he's overcoming and he's winning. He's winning through losing. He's overcoming by being overcome. And that's marvelous. It's incredible for those of us who have eyes to see. And so we want to take note of the fact that he is passive, but he is still winning the victory here. Why is he going through these things? He's fulfilling prophecy like Isaiah 50 verse 6, written hundreds of years before. He's doing it. God's plan is coming to pass. Why is he going through things like this? Why are these things written to encourage suffering Christians? To encourage suffering Christians? To encourage suffering Christians? This book was written to Roman Christians that were being persecuted and mistreated for their faith by a Caesar that hated the church and hated Christians. And Mark is saying to them that you can endure this because Jesus endured it and he overcame it. You can endure because he overcame it himself. God overcame sin and evil and misery himself, and therefore gives us the ability to do it as well. Follow the example of Jesus, Peter would say. Endure it. Go through it and be encouraged by your Savior. And so quickly, how do we deal with evil in light of what Christ has done? How do we deal with it? The mockery and the suffering and the hardship that comes our way. And I want us to think about, first of all, we have to recognize that it's coming. You know, that first generation of Christians that Mark was writing to after Christ came and lived and died that was suffering like that, that's so foreign to us in the United States, but it won't be for long. It won't be for long. So many of the things that the scriptures speak to are seen as archaic at best, or dangerous at worst, and must be opposed. Things like our views on marriage and divorce, abortion and homosexuality, just to name a few, are increasingly under attack in our culture. You see it in the entertainment world, you see it in the political sphere, and we need to be ready for it, friends. We need to prepare ourselves. We need to recognize the way things are going, know what we believe and why we believe it, and then stand up and be accountable and be accounted. The scriptures say, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. And we must be able to parse it out and know the difference and stand for righteousness. Jesus, Hebrews 13, suffered outside the gate. And therefore we are called, Hebrews 13:13, to go outside the camp and bear the reproach that he endured. We must bear the reproach. We must endure as he endured. There are times, friends, when it is right to be silent. I mean, if I were in Jesus' shoes, I mean, I would have spoken up and spoken out. I would have defended myself. Yeah. That would have been my temptation and my tendency, but Jesus doesn't. But there are other times when staying silent is sin. There are other times when not speaking is wrong, and we have to speak up and we have to speak out. That's part of what being salt and light is in a dark and dying, putrefying culture and society. We do it with humility. We do it with love. We do it with compassion. But we're called to do it, dear friends. Hebrews 12 talks about Jesus despising the shame. And you can think about that a couple of different ways. Did he despise it as though he just saw the shame as a little thing? Like it's not even a thing, the shame that I'm enduring because of what's on the other side of it. Or did he despise it in the sense that he just absolutely hated it, but he went through it because of what's on the other side? It could be both. We could count it a small thing. We could count it a thing to be hated and despised, but as long as we look to the future and look to the beyond, that our God has dealt with evil. Our God has dealt with sin. And someday, in the not too distant future, it will be fully removed from our experience. Whether we go to be with him and it's absent, or he comes back for us and he removes it, the time is coming. And in the meantime, we identify with that which is good. We stand against that which is evil or wrong. And we continue to tell people that there's hope, that there's an opportunity to believe in the one who was good and did good and who does eradicate sin. We call people to look to Christ, to trust in him, and then follow after him. Let's close with prayer.